Hello and welcome to A Responsible Day for the seventh day of Shavat. Today we're going to be seeing really one later response of Moshe Feinstein's Inigrat Moshe, but to get to the one that was dated 7th of Shvat of Tavshin Mem of 1980, we first have to briefly see an earlier response of his. Both of these responses will revolve around the question of what status we give to non-Orthodox marriages. And it'll become clear as we go along, but it's worth saying right up front as well that part of the main issue is for us, is for the Orthodox Jews, is what happens if that marriage breaks up and the wife in that marriage then goes off and marry somebody else without a halachic get from the first husband. How do we evaluate the children of that second marriage? That is the primary place where it matters to us. It'll somewhat matter for things like who can marry whom in terms of relationships and who is considered have been related to whom, who was not. But I have, in my meager experience, that arises less often than the bigger question, which is this question of what do we do about these marriages in terms of who counts or not counts as having been married, and if they count as being married, what does that do to children from later marriages of theirs? And as it happens, I'll say it now so that you're not surprised tomorrow. Tomorrow's response then will be by Rav Herzog on a very similar issue. I want to stress, therefore, that I put these tshuvot together at various different times in my life. I come around to them in various different rhythms, in very different ways. So I very much don't try hard not to have these things repeat themselves in this way. It just happens to have worked out this way, and that's the way it is. But it's not an attempt of mine to sort of make sure we see this topic together. Let's start also by thanking Rabbi Jacob Bromwich, David Hochhauser, and the OU for making this shiurim available to you online. It's a gift from them to us that they do so, and we greatly appreciate it. So the first of the shiurim that we're going to see is in Shuri Igrot Moshe and Evan Ezer, and the first time Rav Moshe Feinstein addressed Evan Ezer questions of marriage and divorce is primarily what Evan Ezer is, of issues between husbands and wives. This is in Simon Pei Bet, response number 82. And here the question is about the level of the woman's consent necessary in Kiddushin in creating the beginnings of a marriage, and also about what the status is of witnesses. You need witnesses. We'll talk about that in the responsum. You need witnesses for a marriage in Judaism, but they have to be valid witnesses. So what makes one an invalid witness? What kind of heresy, for example, will render one an invalid witness? Now, the responsum isn't actually dated, but it refers to a case that happened in Tofresh Ayin Zion, which is 1916 or 1917. 17 in Uzda, right? Back when Rav Moshe Feinstein was still back in Russia, and he hadn't moved there to America yet, so he's living there, and somebody asked him the following question. There was a group of kids, basically, and these kids are not the most responsible or the most well-behaved, and they're just hanging out, and they're doing crazy kid stuff, right? So one of them, but they're teenagers, not kids like children, like teenagers, and one of them takes the hand of a girl, puts a ring on it, and says, Ariat Mikudeshet Li. And she didn't throw it away right away. And there were two other young men there. Now, these two other young men are A, Chashudim Ba'arayot. Everybody suspects that from their conduct, from their behavior, there is a suspicion that they have had inappropriate sexual relations. And inappropriate sexual relations, when we say Chashudim Ba'arayot, means ones that are prohibited, right? It's not just that they're having sex when they shouldn't be having sex. They're doing it with people with whom they're prohibited. Now, it might just be that it means women who haven't gone to mikvah, because that might count for the purpose of this discussion as Ariot. We're not going to get into the details of that. And they're also suspected of being of Chilul Shabbos, of violating Shabbat, and a lot of other Yisurim, and a lot of the other prohibitions. And to further our suspicions about them, one of them learns in the gymnasiot, in the secular school system. So we're going to get to why that's a problem. That might give good indication that he has violated Shabbat in public. And everybody assumes these two boys are kofar, meaning that they've denied fundamental claims of the Torah and of Halacha. And denying fundamental claims of the Torah and Halacha, I don't know why it strikes me now that it's worth stressing, but denying those central claims puts oneself in very important terms outside the camp of the Jewish people. So today you have all complicated questions about who counts as the Tinok Shedishba, who is really responsible for their actions, not responsible for their actions, but in terms of testimony, as Rav Moshe Feinstein is going to talk about, we assume that if one is a kofar, one denies fundamental principles of Judaism, then one's testimony doesn't count for halakhic purposes. And if there's no testimony, then that will mean that maybe this is a marriage that occurred, a kiddushin that occurred without any witnesses. And if that happens, that changes halakhic status as well, as we'll say. So one is a broad kofar. He denies you know, many propositions of Judaism. And the other one, as far as we know, is the, all we know about him is that he's kofar. He denies the redemption by Mashiach. He denies that there will be an eventual, a future redemption of the Jewish people. So one thing that Rosh Hashanah says is that when it comes to being kashur al ha'arayon, we don't actually need proof for that. Even if there aren't witnesses that this person actually did it, it already makes them, he thinks, maybe pasul eidus for kiddushin, pasul invalid to be a witness on kiddushin, because kiddushin is an issue that we have reason to believe doesn't matter so much to him, and he doesn't care so much about it, and therefore we can't trust, or he doesn't isn't a valid person to say, yes, this happened in the right way, because it doesn't matter so much to him. Going a step further, the one who learned in the gymnasia in the secular school system at that time, so it's well known to everybody that you can't learn in our times in these schools without violating Shabbos. So there are different schools, different times, right? There are times in America, there have been times in America when schools gave various exams on Shabbos. So there came a point where people said to them, well, I can't take my exam on Shabbos, so can you make an arrangement for me? And there came a point where the schools did, and then there came a point where they fundamentally, basically, usually don't even have the exam on Shabbos at all. But if you knew somebody who had gone to college, let's say, in 1897, and all the exams were on Shabbat, and there was no leniency and leeway made for those who wanted something other arrangement, you would know that a person who went there had violated Shabbos. And that means, for much of it, it says, that kind of knowledge is valid even if we don't have witnesses to the actual fact that. So the guy says, I went to gymnasia, that's all I'm telling you. I'm not telling you I violated Shabbat. You have witnesses I violated Shabbat? The answer is, we don't need witnesses that you violated Shabbat, because we know that attendance in that school necessarily means the violation of Shabbat. And there are other times in Allah, Rav Moshe points to that, where we don't have to see an actual act to know that it occurred, and we nonetheless accept testimony of something that clearly leads to that act, and that will be good enough for us to assume it. Here too, the very fact of attendance at the gymnasia at the secular school is enough for us to know that there was still Shabbos that went on. So once somebody has violated Shabbat in public, they become pasul eidut at a Torah level. They're not valid as witnesses, because the violation of Shabbat is like the violation of everything. So then he says, we got to think about it. When we're talking about Chilul Shabbos, we might just mean that he carried in a place where there wasn't an Eruv. He carried his books to school, from school, whatever it was. So that, unfortunately, would be a Rabbanan, not unfortunately, but it would be a Rabbanan violation of Shabbat. It would be a violation of Shabbat at a rabbinic level. And Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks that if you violate Shabbat only at a rabbinic level, then you're not going to be a pasul le'edut. You're not going to be completely invalid as a witness, because at the Torah level, this person is still a valid witness. I think there's what to talk about there, but he takes that for granted. He also takes for granted that nowadays we don't have a Rishut HaRabim on a Torah level. That's important for Eruv initiatives. The first step of building an Eruv around any community is deciding that there's no Rishut HaRabim in that community. Rav Moshe Feinstein is saying, we don't have anywhere Rishut HaRabim. That's a whole discussion of its own. But that would mean that this person is not yet a Pasul Eidut on a Doraita level. And if he's not yet a Pasul Eidut on a Doraita level, it would mean that on a Doraita level, on a Torah level, maybe the marriage had a good witness to it. Maybe this girl needs a get and has to get out of this marriage or stay married, but maybe she's married. Another option you could say is, well, we know that you write notes when you're in school. It was clear that you were required to write notes. It wasn't like you go to school and just listen. You had to write notes. And so writing is a violation of Shabbat. A claim that could have been made, since the Ramah paskins this way, is that you could argue that maybe when you write non-Hebrew writing, meaning non-Torah script, maybe that doesn't count as Doraita writing for the purpose of Hilchot Shabbat. And then again, that would mean this guy isn't yet a Pasul Eidut on a Torah level, isn't yet an invalid witness on a Torah level. So Rav Moshe Feinstein points to a Beit Shmuel, who argues that that's not true, that even writing non-Jewish script and non-Hebrew script counts as writing on Shabbat, and he proves it from that if you use that script for a get, for a bill of divorce, but in the Torah says about a bill of divorce, v'chatav, the husband has to write her a bill of divorce. That sounds like, therefore, that non-Jewish script can count as writing for halakhic, for biblical Torah purposes. And if so, that would be true for this case as well. So what about that Ramah? So the Rav Moshe Feinstein says, "Ein halacha kedvarav." This is one of those cases, and they're worth watching always to remember that it's not true that we just follow blindly when certain posts tell us what to do. In this particular case, the Beit Shmuel came along and told us that this is not a psak of the Ramah that we follow. We don't accept that. So therefore, we think this guy is pasul eidut because he writes in the gymnasia for sure, and writing on Shabbat is a prohibition, is a biblical prohibition of Shabbat, and therefore he's pasul at a biblical level. Except that another argument you can make, especially based on a Rambam, there's a Rambam who wrote, a well-known Rambam, it's an important Rambam to know for lots of reasons, and it's important to absorb because it's generally accepted that this is the way to see it. The B'nai HaTovim, the Rambam writing about the Karaites. In his time, the big religious problem was Karaites. These were Jews who had decided that they knew better how Judaism should look than the traditional Chazal version of Judaism, and they created their own Judaism, and they're called Karaites. The Rambam says the original Karaites themselves, they were doing it on purpose, and they count as willful sinners and intentional sinners, and they have all sorts of terrible things predicted for them. But then he writes, the Rambam writes, and this is, as I said, become very well accepted, that B'nai HaTovim, their children and grandchildren, they're like a Tinok Shenishba. And this is where this idea comes from. So what does that mean, they're like a Tinok Shenishba? The Gemara recognizes the concept of Tinok Shenishba. Tinok Shenishba in the Gemara is a child who literally was taken captive as a child and raised in a non-Jewish environment. In our times, the best example of a real literal Tinok Shenishba would have been those Jews who left their children in, let's say, Christian convents during World War II, and the Christians were doing really a favor. Some could argue, and in some of the places it was true, that they were thinking they could grab this soul for Christianity, but there are plenty of examples and stories of people in these convents, Christians in these convents, who acted in all the best human ways you can imagine. They raised the kids, after the war they looked for the parents to bring them back, and if they didn't bring them back, they found relatives, all the wonderful things. Let's suppose, for whatever reason, a convent takes in that kid and raises the kid, and the parents never come back for the kid, and they have no way of finding them, and they have no way of this. So they raise the kid as a, now let's even the best scenario. They raise the kid and they tell the kid, you're Jewish, but that's all the kid knows about it. So halachically, we think that that kid is a shogeg, that boy or girl doesn't, Hashem doesn't hold it against them. They have to eventually go and look and find out what the truth is and what they should be doing, but they don't hope for that. So the Rambam applied that concept to the grandchildren of these Karaites, which is, and the Chiddush, the novelty of that is, that these children and grandchildren aren't being raised by people who took them captive, and they're not being raised in a non-Jewish environment in the sense that Karaites also thought of themselves as Jewish. In fact, Karaites thought of themselves as the better version of Judaism. So nonetheless, the Rambam said, we follow, because it helps out a lot with how we interact with fellow Jews who see Judaism, unfortunately, in a way that we think of as not only misguided, but completely false. So that's an important category. And today, it applies to, let's say, Reform and Conservative Jews. Maybe the original ones who knew better, not. But today, they're Tinok Shenishba. So if you're going to say that he's a Tinok Shenishba, that means that we don't think of any of their sins as being willful sins. And therefore, you would say, so these people in this wedding are not willful sinners. They're Tinoko Chenishbu. They are captive children, as it were. And therefore, maybe they're still valid witnesses because they haven't violated the Torah willfully. So the Moshe Feinstein says, this is his plaque. I'm not saying this is the way we follow it, but as important ramifications to think about if we do follow it, and if we don't, we have to figure out why. He says, Mikol Makom Le'inyan Psul Le'edut, but in terms of being valid witnesses, they're just as invalid as anybody else because it's true. We don't think of them as being any worse than non-Jews in what they do, meaning, if you have a Jew who knows everything about what they're supposed to be doing, they're not a Tinok Shenishba, but they grew up in an Orthodox home, and they had the best education, and all the things going. And then they, God forbid, leave the religion and act in ways that are against the Torah. So that's in many ways almost worse than a non-Jew, because the non-Jew, many of these non-Jews aren't really violating the seven Noahide laws. So Moshe Feinstein is willing to concede that when we say that somebody's Tinok Shenishba, it means that they're no worse than non-Jews. But they're no better than non-Jews either, he says. And therefore, they're still postulates, they're still invalid for testimony. Now, that's an important claim to make, because he's saying that when we say something is a shogeg, you're doing it unintentionally, and therefore it's not held against you in the sense of a willful sin. That's true, and yet it is held against the person in the sense of being able to be valid as a witness. To be a valid witness, one has to be actively keeping the Torah and doing their best, and not just doing their best, doing something that meaningfully means, counts as doing one's best, as fulfilling the Torah. And if they're not fulfilling the Torah, they can't count as witnesses. The Tinok Shenishba category, he says, counts in terms of trying to bring them back to Judaism, spending time and effort on trying to bring them close, which we don't do which it's not our responsibility. Rav Moshe Feinstein felt it's not our responsibility to do that for non-Jews, right? There's no deep responsibility. I think Chabad today feels, some of them in Chabad feel that responsibility for non-Jews as well. So Moshe Feinstein saying, it doesn't necessarily apply to non-Jews, but for Jews, them, for sure, we're going to try to bring them closer to Judaism. But that doesn't mean that they count as witnesses, and that they can count as witnesses before they come back. And then he goes another step. this today is a very common read. Right? Jews who have left Judaism grew up in a non-observant home, grew up in a way they didn't know. Rav Moshe Feinstein, at least in 1916, 1917, he was a very young man at the time. It could be as he experienced life more and got clearer on life that he had a different perspective. But here in the earlier tshuva, he says, "Avam istaber she'in lomar klal she'im nechshavim kenishbut." I don't think we could even necessarily apply this category to them. And the reason he gives is because they're around Orthodox Jews. They're around fully observant Jews. So they're around fully observant Jews. They're seeing the truth. And since they're seeing the truth, they could have come to realize that it's their responsibility to join in that truer picture of what Judaism is all about. That's a very radical, not radical, but it's a very strong claim, meaning strong in the sense of severe or strict, because it means, and this is a hard question to think about, that seeing the truth is enough to obligate us to join that truth, even if we see that truth as if we are from outside of it. It would, for example, mean a lot of things about our attitude towards non-Jews and towards the propriety of them living the lives they live when they see Jews saying the hard questions. I'm not saying the right answer, that's hard questions. But in any case, in our case, since these people have chosen to continue on the path that they grew up with, so then he thinks they don't count as Tinok Shenishba anymore. They don't count as a captive child. A captive child has just grown up completely his whole life in this non-Jewish environment. That's all he knows, or she knows. But these people, since they've lived with other Orthodox Jews, and they know what Orthodoxy is, they know what observance is, he's not sure that they can count as Tinok Shenishba. Again, that's another claim with many, many ramifications for our times. So the first kid who went to the gymnasia, we have good public information that he's violated Shabbat, and there we're good. But the other kid, and the other potential witness, it wasn't so well known. And therefore, it's not like it's, everybody understands these facts about it. They're like stories about this kid. Stories may be true, they may not be true. So there are much of interesting things. You'd probably need witnesses to what he has or hasn't done before you'd be allowed to discount him as a witness. And therefore, it seems like we find ourselves in the situation that we have a Kiddushin where there was one valid witness at the Kiddushin, and the Rambah says that when you have one valid witness Kiddushin, so the smag had held that even though we ordinarily say you're required to have two witnesses for a Kiddushin to be valid, and it's not because we don't know that it happened, it's because it's just part of the ceremony, the smag held that if the couple agrees that the wedding happened and there was only one witness to it, he thought that would be good enough. We don't generally rule this way. In this case where it comes up and we have to worry about it, so I mean we don't rule this way to allow ourselves to do that, but where it comes up in this case, we're much finding things we have to worry about it. Now it is true, he says, that when there's a problem of igun, of a woman being left without any recourse for animation, let's say the husband in this case had completely disappeared. So I think Rav Moshe Feinstein would have written a different shuva, which he said, it's true, the smag says this, but we don't really follow that, and therefore we can, whatever it is, I think he would have said, we can find ways around it for her. Because in a place of igun v'dochak, we have pressure, or there's a worry about her being stuck forever, there are marot that you can rely on the mikilim, that this one witness doesn't make anything out of a wedding. But Rav Moshe Feinstein says, but if you could be, that if you try hard enough, and you offer him some money, and you offer him this, you offer him that, he'll give her a get. So if he'll give her a get, that's a much better way to go. So that's the first tshuva. And the important principles for our second tshuva are going to be things about who counts as a witness, who doesn't count as a witness, and what lack of observance does or doesn't do to our understanding of your role in these situations. So the second tshuva is from Shur Igret Moshe, from Eben HaEzer, Chilek Dalet Simon Nuntet, the fourth time Rav Moshe Feinstein discussed Eben HaEzer issues in Igret Moshe, in the 59th responsum, and this one is dated to the 7th of Shvat of Tavshin Mem of 1980. And he's writing to his student, Rav Nissen Lippa Alpert, who was for many, many years a reshiva at YU, very close student of Rav Moshe Feinstein's, and the cases of a daughter from a second marriage. And the question is whether a Jewish school should accept this daughter into their school. So the mother says, 16 years earlier, this mother had gotten divorced, civilly divorced without a get. Now she has a get. Now she has a husband, a new husband. She has a child from this husband, and she wants to know whether they can admit this child, I think, into a high school, maybe into an elementary school. But they wonder if they can admit her, or they have to worry the child's not Jewish, or a mamzeret, or what they do, what her status is. So, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, the mother is believed. Sorry, the other way around. We wouldn't ordinarily believe a mother to cast aspersions on her daughter. We don't think that's in her right and her abilities. But in this case, we have to believe her, because you could just track it down. state, part of the point of marriage and divorce in a civil society is you have records of it, and the state keeps the records. So if the state has records of this, then it's like it's well known. So it's not a question of we don't have witnesses to it. It seems like there's a wedding, and there's a divorce, and then there's a problem. And also when she married this husband in a civil ceremony, the marriage license would certainly note that she had had a previous marriage and that she divorced from it, and therefore it becomes like a well-known fact, the kind of thing that you don't need any... further evidence to back it up. The reason why that would have been helpful here if you had needed it is that when she said she got married, she also said, but that first marriage happened in a very small room. It wasn't like a big marriage. We had like five couples there. And all of the couples, all the people who were there at the wedding were either relatives or they were people who didn't keep the Torah at all. So we don't really believe this mother because she doesn't have believability for lots of reasons. First of all, she has a stake in the outcome here. And second, we're going to find out she's not an observant Jew, so she's not generally valid as a witness in those ways. But you might have thought, well, she's the only one who brought up the wedding to begin with. So she brings up the wedding, but she also tells us enough information for us to feel comfortable that it wasn't a valid halachic wedding, and therefore we don't have to worry about it. You might say, great, we can rely on that. The answer is we can't believe her. Oh, then don't believe about the wedding itself. So that's what Moshe Feinstein said. But the wedding itself, you don't have a choice because there's public records. So you know that the wedding happened. You can look it up, but you're pretty sure it happened because there's no reason to lie about it because it's a matter of public record. So who was there? Who wasn't there? That's not a matter of public record. Therefore, we have a problem with that, and we have to think about it. So Moshe Feinstein says, but there's another way to think that we can decide that the wedding wasn't valid. And he says, that wedding, that first marriage, was overseen by a reform rabbi. And this woman, the mother, and her husband in the second marriage don't keep mitzvos. And it's easily verifiable that they just act completely non-Jewish in their lives. There's no halacha, there's no mitzvos in their lives that they're doing on purpose to keeping mitzvos, so we have every reason to think they don't keep mitzvos, and therefore we have the ability to think that about their earlier marriage as well, which had a reform rabbi, and that helps us say that it wasn't a halachic marriage. Her parents are also known to be Mechalalei Shabbos, to violate all the mitzvos that there are, meaning they have no connection to mitzvos at all. Which certainly means, and Rosh Fox says, and if you're not sure about it yet, you could make a quick phone call and figure it out. It means that they don't believe in Torah and mitzvos, and the neighbors all know it as well, and so therefore, and he's already said, this is back to our first tshuva that we did earlier today, in this same recording, that you don't need actual witnesses for people who are public heretics, who make known in public their belief systems and their denial of truths that Judaism asserts and is sure of. So then they're puzzled to Eidus, so therefore all of this would mean that the wedding really never happened. So that would be one way to say that the marriage never happened. If the marriage never happened, then her divorce wasn't needed a divorce, and then her child from the second marriage isn't a mamzeret because there was no first marriage. She's not a married woman. So that one way is to say that you're pretty sure that since it was done by a reform rabbi, that everybody who was there must have been an invalid witness. Today you'd want to wonder about that. Whether everybody who's there had a wedding by reform. Anyway, Moshe Feinstein thinks that makes it invalid. But then there's another halachic concept that comes up because the Gemara talks about the fact that Ein Adam Oseh B'Gilato B'Gilat Zedut. In the Gemara's time, the assumption was that when men and women live together, especially if they live there together long term as husband and wife, whether or not they had an actual ceremony, that the husband did not intend for all of his acts of marital relations to be as if he was having random promiscuous sex with another woman. He intended it to be as part of a married life. So that principle, Ein Adam Oseh B'Gilato B'Gilat Zedut, might lead us to assume that we have to think of them as married, even if the particular marriage ceremony that we identify wasn't valid, but he intends to be married. That's where the Gemara seems to take that concept. So Rav Moshe Feinstein held, as he says here, as he's written in many other places already, Rav Moshe Feinstein held that we don't have to apply that principle today. Rav Moshe Feinstein held that today, people don't care about B'Gilat Zedut in that sense. They don't care about whether they're married or not. Support for Moshe Feinstein's view would have been that in this 1980, it's not quite as prevalent. It wasn't quite as prevalent as it is now, but the idea that people just live together and they firmly don't mean it to be a marriage. They intend it to be, we're living together right now, and that's what we're doing, and that's not, and they intended not to be marriage. So that would be helpful to his perspective. And his perspective was, yes, the Gemara says, that might have been true in the time of the Gemara, but these people that we're looking at, it's clearly true that they don't intend it, they don't mean it that way, and they don't in any way intend it to get married. That's his own suggestion. Now, it happens to be that there was another important American rabbi older than Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was the premier halachic authority for a long time, and then he and Rav Moshe Feinstein were both around. Name Rav Yosef Elio Henkin. Rav Henkin created a very famous charity called Ezra's Torah. He was an important American Rav. He just didn't leave as much in writing as Rav Moshe Feinstein did, so I think his reputation has been somewhat eclipsed over time. He has a grandson, Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, who's married to Rabbanit Henkin of Nishmat, who's the founder of Nishmat, and he, Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin, has several volumes of Responsa. So, and they, sadly, very sadly, had a son and a daughter-in-law who were killed in a terrorist attack in the last couple of years. So this Rav Henkin in hell, that it's not true. That even if you think they're not, it's true, maybe, that you think that they don't care about Pilat's Nut anymore, but if they have a civil marriage, so then already it's clear they don't mean it to be Bilad's Nut. So if Henkin held, now is this a cooler or a chumra? Right, if Henkin held that we respect their claim that they're getting married enough that even if they don't do it in the Torah way, that it counts as a valid marriage. It's fundamentally a chumra. It's in some sense, loose sense, it's a respecting of their ideas and their worldview and their way of seeing the world, but it ends up being a tremendous stringency because it means that any such relationship requires a get, whereas Moshe Feinstein's view is that if you can find ways to invalidate that marriage, then it won't require a get. So, Rav Henkin's point was that if you know they intend to be married, it's true, the civil marriage itself does nothing halachically, but once the civil marriage is in there, then you know that the next time they have relations as part of their marriage, they intended to be part of their marriage, and that would be a Maisa Kinyan. And halachically, just living together can create a Maisa Kinyan even for Jews, right? So if a couple doesn't know the Torah or doesn't care so much about the Torah or is interested in the Torah things, but everybody knows they've been living together, so one act of relation they would have would create Kiddushin Halacha. If we mean it doesn't mean it's Bilat's Nut, then the next one could create Nisuin. And that was Rav Henkin's view. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, but that's only where they didn't do some other Maisa Kinyan, some other act that could count as Kiddushin. This is Rav Moshe Feinstein's claim for Rav Henkin would have held. By this time, Rav Henkin is no longer alive. He couldn't tell us what he really held about this. Rav Moshe Feinstein is claiming that Rav Henkin said, a couple lives together and they have a civil marriage, then, they're planning on living together, and living together can count as a Kinyan. Rav Moshe says that only counts as an acquisition, as an act of creating this marriage, if they haven't already gotten married in a way that they think of as a Jewish form of marriage. But if you go to Reform Rabbi, you think the rabbi ceremony in the hall, in the catering hall, in the wedding hall with the wedding invitations, you think that was the Kinyan. That was what created the marriage. If you think that's what created the marriage, then every time you have relations after that, you're not thinking that that's going to create a marriage. You're thinking the marriage is already created. And most of Feinstein thinks that even Rav Henkin therefore would agree that in these situations, you don't have to have a get afterwards. Not that you shouldn't. Better too, because you avoid all these problems. You don't have to rely on these various leniencies, but you don't have to have a get. So that means the first marriage is never a marriage, which means that if the first marriage is never a marriage, then if she got separated from that first husband without a halachic divorce, we don't care. And then Moshe Feinstein throws in, and now too, she's not really married. Right? She's living together with a guy, they had a reform wedding. That for Moshe is not a marriage, and therefore, and all their acts, whatever their private sexual life might be, those will not be acts that create marriage. So they think they're relying on this wedding ceremony, but the wedding ceremony with the Reform rabbi is in fact completely invalid, and therefore it's no problem. Rav Alpert had worried that at least one of the witnesses at the first wedding was a tinok shenishba, was somebody who didn't grow up in any kind of a Jewish environment, and therefore you might think that maybe he's a witness, maybe you have a problem. So Moshe Feinstein rules refers us back to the response we just discussed, in which he says that it doesn't matter that they were tinok shenishba, that still means they're invalid as witnesses. It matters for lots of other important questions, but it doesn't matter in terms of counting them as witnesses. They're still invalid for all as long as they're non-observant. They're invalid for witnesses. More than that, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, as long as people don't believe in reward and punishment by Hashem in the Jewish sense of it, then we can't count them as witnesses because they have no incentive not to lie. They have no reason to think lying is a problem because they think God forbid, there's no judge of ours. There's nothing that tells us whether we're doing right and wrong, and therefore they'll have no incentive to tell the truth in the way that we care about for the purposes of testimony. So he thinks that all such people are invalid as witnesses, regardless of what their life story is. They're just invalid because they don't have the necessary qualifications to be a witness. Now he mentions that with the Karaites, some of them might have been kosher witnesses for Kiddushin, even though they didn't actually believe in Kiddushin, but since they knew that there was a prohibition to bear false testimony, and knew that Hashem punishes that prohibition, he thought that might have been enough in some cases for them to serve as witness. Because that's the crucial thing for Moshe Feinstein, to be a witness. You have to believe in the Torah, you have to believe in Hashem, and you have to believe that Hashem punishes misdeeds such that you know that true testimony is vital to avoid punishment from Hashem. Then he repeats his idea. So in 1980, he's still willing to say it, that if you see a lot of Orthodox Jews around, he thinks that it means you can't really count yourself as a Tinoch Shenishba anymore. That's a hard claim. It's a thing that bears a lot of thing that calls for a lot of thinking and a lot of soul searching, because it would mean that the fact that somebody sees something, even though they don't believe, right? They say, well, those are Orthodox Jews, I'm not one of those. Rav Moshe Feinstein seems to have thought, and this is already, he's at the latest stage in his life, seems to have thought that that's not an excuse, and that by that point, the person needs to have realized, and therefore they stop being a Tinoch Shenishba. That as soon as they see Jews who give the Torah the right way, they stop being a Tinoch Shenishba, they stop being a captive child, and therefore those leniencies go away. That's what he says each time. And therefore, if you can convince the parents to bring the girl to a Jewish school and let her learn about being Jewish and being observant and getting her close, that would be great. And if you can get the parents to also come closer to observance, to be chozrim b'tshuva, to repent and return to proper observance, then you should do that for sure. And then you should also have them get married, because they're not married. As far as Rosh Hashanah, got married by a former rabbi. But he throws in, I think this is an important cautionary tale that we don't, a cautionary note that we don't think about. He says, but don't get them to get married unless they're already observant. Because if they're not observant and we encourage them to marry, and God forbid this marriage breaks up, what's going to happen? They'll get divorced without a get, and that will really create problems. So you don't want to help them get married if you got problems down the road. Better they should live together unmarried like they have been from a halachic perspective. So that's what Moshe Feinstein's view. There are other examples of that, where people jump to encourage somebody to do what seems like a religious act without thinking that down the road it might have greater downsides than it does have upsides. But for our purposes, that is responsible day for the seventh day of Shabbat, Rav Moshe Feinstein, discussing marriages in which some of the people involved are non-observant, non-orthodox, and the ways that doesn't work, and the stringencies and leniencies involved. The biggest of those leniencies being that Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks that as soon as the Reform rabbi officiates at a wedding, that wedding is completely invalid, and the whole rest of those people's married life also doesn't create an actual marriage and halacha, and therefore the lack of a get won't be a problem. With thanks to the OU, Rabbi Jacob Bromwich, David Hochhauser, and to all of you for coming and joining and listening together with me for the seventh day of Shabbat, I bid you a good day.